Good morning. It is Kale and Company live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Great to have you with us. And as always, we are presented by Northeast Delta Dental with individual and family plans designed to fit your lifestyle. Learn more and find your plan at DeltaDentalCoversMe.com. We have a fascinating hour ahead. Our first guest today has been called the quintessential American sports writer, longtime Boston Globe sports writer. You've seen him on TV many, many times on ESPN and elsewhere. And we welcome to the show Bob Ryan. Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning, Ken.
It is a delight to have you with us, and just so many things. I know we could do about 6 hours here, but we'll try to pack things into about 22 minutes or so. I read an article a couple of weeks ago in the Globe, actually online, the online Boston Globe, and you recently saw a game in South Dakota, college basketball game in South Dakota, and it's a great story in itself, but that game marked the 50th state, not to mention D.C. and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, where Bob Ryan has witnessed at least one sporting event. I think that's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, the funny thing is that when it was printed, my wife said, you forgot something. I said, what? U.S. Virgin Islands.
Ah.
I said, oh, my God. In 2003, I covered Boston College in the Paradise Jam in St. Thomas. I had forgotten that one, too.
Wow.
It was a great way to end, too, at South Dakota. They were treating me well. The thing about it is interesting, Ken, there was a headline on both the online and print. And when I saw it online, I called the Sunday sports editor, Greg Lang, and said, Greg, we got to change that headline. Headline said lifelong quest. It was not a lifelong quest. It was very organic. And it didn't occur to me that I could do something like this until I hit around 47th state or so. The last four states were in Delaware, Alaska, Mississippi, and then finally South Dakota. And it never occurred to me. It was never a plan. It just somehow dawned on me when I about 8 or 9 years ago that I was closing in on 50, and wouldn't it be fun if? So that's how that came about.
Yeah, and I can see how that does happen organically with the job you had for so many years with the Boston Globe, and you still contribute to the Globe on a semi-regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
But it all began in Trenton, New Jersey.
It did. I was born in Trenton and raised, and my father, at the time of my birth, for 4 years in the late 40s, was affiliated in various ways with the Trenton Giants, the Class B Interstate League team affiliate of the New York Giants. And we were going to get, I was an only child. My mother was a good sports fan, too. And they were taking me to games. There was no question. I was going to games from that era time of infancy and toddlerhood, and including the night in 1950 when Willie Mays made his organized baseball debut. So that's where it got started. Then the college thing kicked in when he took a job as the assistant athletic director at Villanova in 52 to 54. And then I got involved with college basketball and football. And that's interesting, Ken, because when I was doing the research of my own self for this story, and I wanted to identify in each state what sports events I had seen in each state and then, tally it up, it didn't surprise me at all that the two sports in which I had seen games in the most or been to events in the most states were college basketball with 38 and minor league baseball with 31, because those were really my foundation sports growing up.
Yeah, yeah. Your two passions, I know, and you're very fortunate to have both of your parents very much into sports, as you mentioned your father, but your mother was actually very instrumental in acquiring some tickets for a number of great sporting events in your youth.
Yes, my father died when I was 11 in May of 57, and the following September, Army and Notre Dame were resuming a rivalry that had of course, begun back in 1913 with the famous Rockne and to Dorais 35-13 conquest of the cadets, and went into 1947, and it was one of the major sporting events in America throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s. For some reason, I don't remember, but there was some spat, and they ceased the rivalry after 1947. Well, they resumed it in 57, and in Philadelphia at Municipal Stadium, and my mother got tickets for that game. Wow. And that not too many women would have had that foresight, I don't think, frankly, at the time. And she got tickets for that game, and it wasn't the only time that she stepped up to kind of feed the monster here, the sports monster they had created. They had this little, you know, and as I put it, she was a wife, a widow of one sports nut and the mother of another.
Yeah.
And she stepped up several times during my adolescence as well, and I'm really grateful to her for doing that.
And in all 29 different sports across the United States, and we mentioned D.C., Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, Canadian provinces, you've seen it all. Do you have a favorite venue? I know you love the Old Garden. I know you love.
I did love the Old Garden. Well, in baseball, it was far and away, it was Tiger Stadium. And, you know, people often, oftentimes say they remember the first time they went to a baseball park, the green, and you went with your father, your uncle, and Uncle Henry and all that. I don't remember that because that's all we ever did. So I don't have any idea what was my first time in a major league park. It would have been either the Polo Grounds or, at that point, Scheib Park, before it became Connie Mack Stadium in Philadelphia. However, in 1972, on opening day of both the hockey and basketball seasons, the Celtics and Bruins were both in Detroit, believe it or not. Detroit.
Wow.
The Bruins were opening in the Olympia, and the Celtics were opening at Cobo Arena. That afternoon was Game 4 of the 1972 ALCS.
Wow.
Between the Tigers and the A's. And so we already had Harold Kayser and Cliff Keen covering that game, and they sent Fran Rosa, the Bruins guy, and me to do sidebars. The Boston Globe had four people covering the Game 4 of the ALCS in 1972. Well, when I walked into Tiger Stadium, I had that glow. I had that feeling that everybody else talking about their first time as a child in a ballpark. I had never seen a ballpark that was everything was green on green on green, and it just had for 53,000 seats, it had an intimacy that you can't describe. And I fell in love with Tiger Stadium, and I would go out of my way at any point to go to a game in Tiger Stadium. And then finally in 1999, when they closed the ballpark, my wife and I went out for a weekend series to say goodbye to Tiger Stadium. It was against the Red Sox. I was hoping it was against somebody else. I mean, I can see the Red Sox anytime I want. But it was against the Red Sox anyway. That was my favorite venue in terms of all in baseball. And then in basketball, the Pennsylvania Palestra was where I was kind of had my confirmation, if you will, of a basketball, and that remains my favorite basketball venue.
So many Big Five matchups at the Palestra in Philadelphia over the years. Just a legendary venue, which I never had the opportunity to visit. Is it still around?
Yes, it is.
It is.
It's still the home of Penn, and
yeah.
The no longer the Big Five as we knew it in the 50s, 60s, 70s has been shredded. But I'm not sure exactly what the policy is right now. I know the last time I was there was 10 years ago when St. Joe's had that last great run. Remember when they got to the Eastern Regional Final?
Right.
I went to a game there in February of 2014. So, but it's still there. Penn still uses it. The heyday, the great days are over, but I still wouldn't mind going back there at least one more time.
Well, I guess I still have time, too, you know. So,
yeah, you do.
And I better do it quickly. you talked about four Boston Globe writers in Detroit to cover the World Series.
No, ALCS.
ALCS, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't even a World Series.
Right, okay, ALCS in 1972. And that's amazing. I mean, you'd never find that today. I mean, the Red Sox were not involved, so you'd never find
that
today.
You're lucky if a major paper, the dwindling number of major papers, sends somebody to a major event at all. the numbers have shrunk. But the idea that we had four people at an ALCS game, you know, as circumstantial as it was, because it, the incredible coincidence of the Celtics and Bruins being in the same city on opening night, is not to be repeated. But still, the idea that the Globe would see fit to do that—but that's the way the world was then, and it was a wonderful time to be in the business.
Well, I want to talk after the break about something you did in 1972 that I'm very jealous of, taking a tour of minor league baseball parks. And we'll do that with Bob Ryan. We have to take a quick break. Bob Ryan is with us, and we will continue to chat with Bob right after the break here on WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. We are presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, Kale and Company Live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. So glad to have the great Bob Ryan with us. And he's been covering sports in Boston since what, 1968?
Yes,
1968 for the Boston Globe, but you've seen him on TV many, many times over the years. And mentioned before the break, in 1972, you took a tour of minor league baseball parks that included Trois-Rivières, Quebec. I know they had a Cincinnati Reds farm club there at one time, and it was in the Eastern League. But how was that ballpark? I actually saw it at one time in Canada. So
I don't remember much now about the ballpark specifically. I'd have to go back and look at my book and see how I described it. I do remember describing the clientele. And the whole feel of it was so different, and obviously so cool. Okay, what happened was this: in 1971, I went to the boss and I looking for something for me to do in the summer that I would like to do, rather than him giving me something to do that I did not want to do, and or would be bored with. So I said I would like to take a short road trip with the Pawtucket Red Sox. They were then in the Eastern League. They were not yet in the International League.
Right.
And they were going to take a three-day trip to Elmira, New York, where they were going to play five games because of two rainouts that they had had earlier in the season. So on July 4th, that night, after I got on the bus with the team, and I went to Elmira, New York, where I spent 3 days. Okay, long story short, I wrote a two-part series on my experiences with the Elmira Red Sox. I mean, with the Pawtucket Red Sox. I got a phone call the next day from a Mr. Ned Bradford, a Little Brown publisher in Boston, that he liked the story, and he did a little research, and there hadn't been much out there on minor league baseball, and maybe there's a book in all this. I said, oh, wow. So we met, and we got a deal going done, and the next summer I would do research for a minor league baseball book. And so that's how it came about, Ken. And in the summer of 72, I had a 2 weeks vacation. I was a young writer there. I only had 2 weeks vacation, and I didn't have much time. So I took my 2 weeks vacation to set up two different trips for minor league baseball. The first one was in June, and I went to West Palm Beach, Kinston, North Carolina, and Appleton, Wisconsin. I sneaked a weekend trip up into Trois-Rivières in the middle of all this. And the second trip in August, I went to Albuquerque, Visalia, California, Ogden, Utah, and Honolulu, where there was a team called the Hawaii Islanders that was an independent team, owned their own players. They had hopes of getting into the big leagues in those days. And their team consisted of a lot of veterans that people would know the names that were past their prime, but they were very good AAA players at that point. That's how I got to go from Trois-Rivières to Honolulu and go to these ballparks and whet my appetite for minor league baseball.
Wow! I is that book still around? It's got to be somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
Just last week, someone contacted me and did I know that I have anything about it? I said no. Try Amazon, and he said they did, and he got back to me. No, they didn't have any. So you're going to have to get lucky somehow, some way, and some
scrounge somehow.
It's an interesting look back. the way the world was then, and the communications. I remember talking about how you'd be out in the West, and you might as well, you couldn't get any news. I mean, you were like getting news 3 days later. I mean, and think about the way we live world now, the instantaneous world that we live in. Anyway, I called it my baseball PhD. I learned so much about baseball throughout those trips, and saw some fascinating people. And we, by the way, in Trois-Rivières Vieira, that team that year, they had Dan Dreesen, Tommy Carroll, and Joel Youngblood, and oh, a guy named Griffey.
Yep.
Griffey.
Yep.
And so I'm thinking that maybe that little baby Ken Jr. was in the crib, you know, when I was in Trois-Rivières Vieira. Who knows, you know? But seriously.
That's right. Ken Griffey Sr. Yes, Ken Griffey Sr. played for that team. Yep.
One thing I remember, I love this, that there was a rainy afternoon in which I sat in a hotel room for 2 hours talking with the manager of the Reading Phillies, Jim Bunning.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Before he ran for Congress and before he became a two-term or three-term senator. The most thing I remember about with Jim Bunning was he was railing about the modern ball player.
So, in 1972. But, you know, Trois-Rivières did not win the Eastern League title that year. It was won by the West Haven Yankees.
Oh, okay.
I worked for the West Haven Yankees that year.
Well, who was their marquee player?
Actually, it was a guy by the name of Charlie Spikes.
Oh, I can tell you, I got a Charlie Spikes story.
Oh, great. You have a story for everybody.
I got two of them. The first one is, in Kinston, they showed me where Charlie Spikes hit a home run in left field over the warehouse. by the way, and the other one was, in one your early Cheers episode, Sam Malone was talking about giving up a home run to Charlie Spikes.
That's right.
And I flipped out because you know, it wasn't the kind of reference that would refer that most people would even have any knowledge of. And I said, who wrote this? This guy's a baseball fan. He could have picked a better known name than Charlie Spikes. So that's I just got to throw a quick aside. When you go to minor league parks, they always like to point out the landmarks, you know.
Sure.
And when I got to Appleton, in Goodland Field in Appleton, Wisconsin, they showed me where Boog Powell once hit one in the Piggly Wiggly parking lot.
The Piggly Wiggly parking lot. There you go.
That's right.
There you
go. In right field. That, I'll tell you, that's a poke.
But that West Haven Yankees team had Charlie Spikes, Otto Velez, who went on into the major leagues, and the ace of the staff was Scott McGregor.
All right, Antonio Velez. I can still hear Bob Shepard saying, Velez.
That's right. So I want to know, Bob, before we have to wrap this up, and it's gone by much too quickly, what were the sporting events that you attended in New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont?
Well, New Hampshire, we've got, of course, UNH. I've seen UNH football and basketball, and also minor league baseball at Fisher Cats.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think of anything else. And then in Vermont, of course, UVM basketball and the and minor league baseball in Vermont. And so those are the two in those two states.
At Centennial Field in Burlington.
Yes, it's at Centennial Field.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And I just went in the company of my great friend Tom Brennan. The great coach at Vermont, who put them on the map, as you know, and still is like is probably the most famous person in Vermont right now, other than Bernie Sanders. And those are how I got them done. I remember going to a really rainy, miserable afternoon to see a Boston University UNH football game, I do remember that. And I've been to UNH. I went up there. Oh, this is you'll love this. I went up there because they were having a promotion. They had a record-breaking losing streak, and they had a promotion going about if they could break the losing streak, you would get to go to the game, and I went up to cover that game. But I was there, and I've been there about three or four times, actually, total.
Yeah. You never got to Gill Stadium in Manchester?
I didn't.
No.
And,
It's still around. So you can still do it.
Well,
or historic.
I'm planning on going to minor league parks in the summer here at 24 in New England. So
terrific. Terrific.
Yeah.
So you covered the Celtics, Bob, for many, many years, decades.
Yes.
And so is this current Celtics team comparable to any of those great teams that you covered in the past?
Well, you know, they haven't done it yet. They have to take the final step, and they haven't done it. They are built to win. This is their time. They've got everything that you need. They have all the ingredients, talent-wise. They don't need any infusion of talent. They have enough. They have the most talented starting five. They have the best roster, probably 1 to 7 or 8 in the league, maybe even 9, because Luke Kornet's a much better player than people think. And now with Tillman, maybe 10. It's a matter of playing, you know, under the tough, under pressure. They wilted against the Warriors. They wilted against the Heat last year. They've got to take that emotional step. But it's not about talent. And of course, everybody needs health. You can say that's a given. You got to go in there healthy. But Danny and then Brad have assembled a team that absolutely is as talented as any team in the league. As far as comparison to the history, tough history to compare with here. You know, they've got the very, very, very high bar, and that's just the way it is in Boston with these teams. And so I'm not going to put them on a level with, but I do tell you that in the contemporary game, they have enough talent to win the 2024 championship.
I got to tell you, the two different people gave me the book Scribe. And my late mother, who somehow got an autographed copy from you, and my son-in-law, who found it at a yard sale not too long ago, didn't know I had it, but gave it to me. But there was an inscription in this, and I don't know if I should bring it up or not, but we just have a second here or two. And there was an inscription that you wrote in the book that my son-in-law found at a yard sale, and you wrote it, said, "To Teresa, hope there's a nice vacation in the works when this is over. Thanks for everything."
I'm thinking hard here. I don't have any idea.
That's the inscription. But anyway, that was that. What are you working on now, Bob?
A sequel to In Scoring Position, the book that Bill Chuck and I did, the aforementioned In Scoring Position, which tell people that will know, is it's the treasure trove of stuff that you find inside box scores. And I've scored every game that I've been to at every level since the beginning of the 1977 season. 9 scorebooks worth of stuff. Everywhere I go, I never go leave home without a scorebook, because you never know when a baseball game is going to break out. And this is the stuff you find, the history, the tidbits, and now we're going to do a sequel, because the publisher asked us to do one. So we're very pleased about that.
I can't wait. I missed the first one, but I'm somehow going to catch up with it. And the second one is coming out when? Any idea?
Spring of 25.
All right. Well, I hope
we're in progress. We're writing right now.
I hope we can have you back before then, because it's a lot of fun to reminisce about these things. And Bob, I certainly appreciate your time.
Well, you know where to find me, as they say.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Okay,
take care.
And bye-bye.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, and working on another book. And just terrific. Could talk for hours on end with him. All right, we'll take a break, and then we're going to have another famous sports personality with us. Ann Liguori is going to join us right after this break. Kale and Company continues right here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Welcome back. Kale and Company live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. And our guest on this portion of the show is the amazing Ann Liguori. Ann, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure, and I've known how amazing Ann is for decades. You were part of a show that I once hosted out of Boston called The Sports Final, and you were one of our top correspondents. Do you even remember doing that show?
I do.
Did you ever get paid, Ann? I had trouble getting paid
from
that show.
I was 12 years old.
Yeah, you had to be. You had to be 12 years old. But no, it was actually a show that was kind of ahead of its time, because it was before all the 24-hour sports networks, and a gentleman by the name of Tom Starr put it together, and he really had a lot of foresight. That was not very well capitalized, let's put it that way, but they managed to get it on the air, National Sports Radio Network, really for the first time, and I know you were a part of that.
Yeah, I know. That was, a long, long time ago. I'm so happy you gave me that opportunity. I think I was just a few years out of college at that point.
Yeah. Well, Ann, you've covered 26 Masters golf tournaments, dozens of other major golf championships, over 40 U.S. tennis championships, multiple Olympics, and the first female host of a talk show on WFAN, The Fan in New York. I'd need a whole show just to read your resume, but she has a new book out there, folks, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf, with a foreword by CBS's Jim Nantz. And, Ann, when did you begin your love affair with the game of golf?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when I was growing up, I played every sport, it seems, but golf. And then, I played a lot of tennis. That was my first love, and earned, letters in track and field and in high school, and basketball and volleyball, and played on the boys' tennis team because we didn't have a girls' team growing up in Brecksville, Ohio back then. But I didn't really play golf until I got out of college and eventually got picked to host a show on the Golf Channel. It was the first Wednesday that the Golf Channel was on the air, and my show aired prime time. It was called Conversations with Ann Liguori. And I interviewed all these fascinating celebrities who had a passion for golf. And so the show, it was on for the first 6 years of the Golf Channel's inception. And I started getting all these great invitations to play in these celebrity and charity golf tournaments. And I thought, you know what? I better learn this game. So I started taking lessons, and I fell in love with it. Very difficult game, as you probably know.
Oh, yes, and, I do very well. No, it's difficult.
And that's why I decided, this is my second book. The first book was actually a collection of interviews from that show on the Golf Channel. And that book was called A Passion for Golf, Celebrity Musings About the Game, where I literally talked to everybody from Celine Dion and Samuel L. Jackson to Jim Brown, the football player, and Johnny Bench, all these personalities who loved golf. And with this book, I thought, let me talk to 12 golf legends, and let's talk to them about what they learned from their iconic golf careers that they use in their day-to-day life. And so it's really, it has a lot of universal themes. It's really a lot about life and what they learned from golf that they use day-to-day.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. And I'm sure many of our listeners have seen you on TV, on your various interview shows and on the Golf Channel. And Ann is like the Barbara Walters of sports, except in a much more pleasant way, I think. And you are able somehow, Ann, to get information from your interviewees that very few could. How do you have that knack?
Well, that's a compliment. And interviewing is something that I've wanted to do since I was 8 years old. I'm very fascinated by, with people, and very sincerely curious about other people. But, I do as much research, about my guest as possible. And then it's a conversation. And obviously the golf course helps a lot, because I've been using the golf course as a vehicle to get to know some of the most fascinating people in the world. Now, I did another show called Sports Interview, mm-hmm. and that show aired for, 17 years. And, one of my favorite interviews was with the great Ted Williams. Now, I didn't golf with people on that show, with the legends on that show. But, it just gets back to doing your research and learning as much as you can about your guests, and then making it a conversation and making them very relaxed. And with, a lot of these shows, I interviewed the personalities while we were playing golf. So how much more relaxed can you be?
I guess
they like getting out of the studio, or
yeah,
they like
sure.
getting out of their,
yeah.
Out of the normal places where people do interviews. And they just enjoyed being on a golf course and having a great time.
Did you play golf with Ted Williams?
I did not. Ted was, I interviewed him back when the All-Star Game was at Fenway in the late 90s, and his son, John Henry, mm-hmm. at the time, helped me get that interview. And Ted was ailing, his son said, look, if you come at 11 o'clock with your camera crew and set up, he will have just gotten up from his nap, and he'll be ready to go. He'll be really sharp. And true to that, he came out, and I was ready to go. And, oh, my gosh, the intimidating figure of Ted Williams.
I can imagine, yeah.
And but you know what? He was such an interesting interview. He, at that point, he was, you know, much older and looking back at his career and was, just an amazing storyteller. So that was really, and I really give John Henry, his son, a lot of credit because John helped me get that interview and helped me organize it. So I really was thankful, to do that, to get that interview. I interviewed Mickey Mantle in his restaurant back in the day.
Yeah,
in Manhattan,
New York, yeah.
And yeah. Hank Aaron and Bart Starr and Gordie Howe. But this book, this latest book, it comes out April 2nd. You can order it anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble's Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. I focused on the greatest golf legends, who were old enough to tell stories and to give advice and wisdom. So Jack Nicklaus, and he talks about integrity and sportsmanship and putting family first. And Ben Crenshaw and Tom Watson talks about learning from the best. Gary Player, 88 years young, talks about pursuing your passion. So we have all these, I have six men and six women legends. And it was really a joy to do, and I just think the book inspires everyone, young and old.
Yeah, it is terrific. The parts I have read of it, I haven't read the whole thing as yet. But tell us about your encounters with Jack Nicklaus. I would have to think that he would be fairly intimidating.
I kind of got started my golf coverage at the tail end of his career. And so, but I've gotten to know Jack and his amazing wife, Barbara Nicklaus, through the years, obviously, covering golf as much as I cover all the major championships and a lot of PGA. And I see them around. In fact, I was just doing a keynote speech at the Cognizant Classic about 2 weeks ago down in PGA National. It used to be the Honda Classic. And Barbara Nicklaus was sitting at my table. It was her birthday. And, I can't say enough about Barbara and Jack Nicklaus and all they do for charity. Golf obviously was important to Jack, but not as important as his family. I mean, he would leave a tournament during his prime after playing the third round on a Saturday, and he'd fly back to Florida from wherever he was. He'd attend his son's football game, and then he'd fly back to the tournament and play the final round on Sunday.
Wow.
And he told me, look, it all happened. My career and my success all happened because I made a couple of 4-foot putts, but he said being a father really came ahead of chasing a trophy, and that's true. He has 5 children, about 22 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren.
Wow.
Can you imagine what his family reunions are like?
I can only imagine. The great Anne Liguori is with us. Anne, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
We have to take a quick break here, and Anne's new book is Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. And a fascinating read. In fact, even fascinating if you're not into golf. Really, you don't have to be a golf fan to enjoy this book. It's a great human interest book. And is it out yet?
It comes out April 2nd. You can advance order it, and they start shipping around April 2nd. I had a couple copies they were able to send me, and I did a couple book signings already. But, you can advance order it on, as they said, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and it should be in bookstores about April 2nd.
All right. Outstanding. We'll be right back. We'll continue after these words. Kale & Company live on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Welcome back. Kale & Company live here on WKXL, presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and very pleased to have on Anne Liguori. And Anne is the author of a book just coming out but can be pre-ordered from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. And Ann, thanks for staying with us. We appreciate it. I want to talk about a couple of female golfers, some of the great women's golfers of all time. And Nancy Lopez, I know she's featured in your book. How did Nancy handle her success, which came very early at the age of 19? It could not have been easy.
Exactly. We talked a lot about that. And, you know, she was coached by her father the whole time, never really took any formal lessons from any professional golfers. And she just kind of focused in, and they had a very tight family. And the title of her chapter is Play Happy Golf, Stay Positive. And that is such an important lesson for all of us, whether we're playing golf or in life. And, you know, it's so difficult to do sometimes, you know, with life, the ups and downs and the challenges that are all part of our journeys, right? But she always has a smile on her face. She never got mad at herself. You know, if she made a mistake on the course, you just forgot about it. And you stay in the present and think about the shot you're hitting. And the same is true off the course. You know, just stay positive, as difficult as it is. Look at the bright side. And I love her theme in that chapter, play happy golf. And, you know, I also talked to one of her colleagues who, between Nancy Lopez and Jan Stevenson, Jan's also in the book, they were really the face of the LPGA in the 70s. And they did a lot of work off the course to promote the tour. And particularly Jan, you know, here was this blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aussie girl coming over to the United States as a rookie, and she started winning. And so the LPGA pretty much used her as kind of like her sex appeal to sell the LPGA Tour. And so she gets into that, and, you know, it was tough because a lot of her colleagues on the tour were not happy that she was doing that, you know, posing nude in a bathtub with a bunch of golf balls, and that was very controversial, obviously, at the time. And now, you know, it took her until 2019, Jan Stevenson, to get into the Hall of Fame. She didn't think she would get into the Hall of Fame. You know, she said, listen, if I would have, you know, played more and practiced more instead of doing all this promotional work for the tour, she thought she could have won even more titles. So, you know, it was tough duties back then in the 70s and trying to get the LPGA publicity. And but you know, both women, Nancy Lopez and Jan Stevenson, did a great job. Nancy, you know, won a lot of tournaments very early in her career, and they're both going strong today. It's great to see them. Nancy teaches golf clinics all over the world, and, you know, she makes appearances as, you know, one of the bright stars of the 70s. And Jan Stevenson, I just actually played in a golf event with her a couple weeks ago, and, you know, she's had an incredible life and a lot of ups and downs in her life. She was going to a tournament. Actually, she was playing in a tournament years ago in St. Petersburg and driving home, and somebody ran a red light and crashed into her. I mean, she's lucky she survived. And then a little bit after that, she got mugged in a parking lot at a Miami Heat game. Mm. And her left hand is still not the same. It basically injured three of her fingers, and she still doesn't have feeling in those fingers. And she was able to bounce back from, you know, all her ups and downs. And they're going to, I think she was telling me a couple weeks ago, she optioned her story to a big movie studio.
Oh, wow.
And Margot Robbie may play her.
Oh, wow.
And Margot wanted to kind of take some licenses, you know, as they do in Hollywood, with the script, and make Jan's figure a little more kind of, you know, provocative, even more so than she was back then. You know, making out in the parking lot with guys before she had a tea time, and Jan said that wasn't me, and so now Jan is trying to get the studio to stay true to her story, which you know, stay tuned. We'll have to see how that comes
yeah.
out.
Well, it's certainly fascinating enough, you know, without adding to it. I mean, she had, as you know very well, what a life she has had. But we all know that the ratings for women's golf back in her day would not have been anywhere near what they were without her on the tour.
That's right. And she said, you know, anytime, you know, they wanted her on Johnny Carson, she would get on all the time. So they got a lot of national attention back then, a lot of really good attention. And it's because, you know, she and Nancy and were working overtime to really promote the tour. And, you know, that does take away. Golf is such a, you know, sport where you have to focus and kind of cut out all the distractions, but they were really doing so much just to keep the tour in business.
Yeah, and how was she? I kind of get the vibe from you how she was perceived by other you know, members of the LPGA tour at the time.
Exactly. Well, because the LPGA used her sex appeal to sell the LPGA tour back then, much to the dismay of her fellow competitors. You know, she would go into a locker room and she'd hear people gossip about her and they didn't like it. So she had to deal with, you know, that, whether it was jealousy or just the fact that they didn't like, you know, what the LPGA Tour was doing back then, using, you know, sex appeal to sell the LPGA Tour. And she says she's friendly with most of those women now, but she did say it she didn't think she, you know, would get into the Hall of Fame because of all that. And thank goodness when she got the call. You know, every year she'd tell this great story in the book. Every year, Nancy Lopez, who's on the board of the Hall of Fame, and Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus would call her, say, "Jan, you know, sorry you didn't make it this year. You know, maybe next year." And then in 2019, Nancy called, and Jan wouldn't even let her speak. She goes, "I know, Nancy, I know. You don't have to tell me." She goes, no, listen, you made it this year." And they had a great, you know, cry over that because they're very good friends. So she finally got into the Hall of Fame in 2019.
Wow, that is terrific. Tell us a little bit about Amy Alcott, who used to practice as a youngster by sneaking on to the Riviera Country Club and had no idea that she was spending some time on the greens with some Hollywood luminaries.
Exactly. Amy Alcott, winner of 29 LPGA titles, 3 major championship titles. Her chapter is called Be the Captain of Your Own Ship. And I love this chapter. You know, Amy did not grow up in a golf family. I mean, she had very supportive parents, but she learned the game on her own. She would sneak on to Riviera after school in Los Angeles and play golf with the guys. And she'd be practicing on the putting green, and she'd be there until dark. And her mother would come down and she'd say, "Do you know who this woman is putting next to you?" And, you know, there was this Hollywood starlet dressed to the nines. And it happened to be Rita Hayworth. And Amy said, "Oh, my goodness." And her mother said, "Amy, this is Miss Hayworth. You know, she's famous." And, you know, Amy was a youngster at the time and was so focused on her putting that she didn't even notice Rita. But, yeah, just a great chapter on Amy Alcott, a real individual who really talks about being the captain of your own ship, and that's what she did, and she became a huge success in the golf world.
Alan, I would be remiss not to ask you, where do we stand at the moment with LIV Golf and the PGA? A lot of LIV Golf stars seemingly wanting to rejoin the PGA Tour.
That is a very good question. Nobody knows.
I guess not.
The PGA, I'm heading to the Players' Championship today, and today the commissioner of the PGA Tour, Jay Monahan, is going to speak. You know, he does his annual kind of State of the Golf address every year at the Players' Championship, so it will be interesting to see what he says. I'm not quite sure they even know. The PGA Tour got a $3 billion investment from another group, the Strategic Sports Group, that are owners, billionaires from this country,
yes,
in the United States. And the owner of the New York Mets, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, the owner of Home Depot. So they don't think, I've heard a couple of the players Tiger being one of them, who's on the player policy board. He said, you know, we don't really need the Saudi money, but obviously they want all the best players in the world to compete against each other more often.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how they try to fold these LIV golfers, the top LIV golfers, into the tour, you know, the PGA Tour, which obviously the PGA Tour banned them the second they jumped over to LIV. So a lot of question marks for sure, and maybe we'll get some answers today, but I don't expect them.
Anne Liguori, thanks so much. Anne is the author of the new book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf, with a foreword by Jim Nance. Anne, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. We go back a long way.
We
right?
do, a long way. Thanks so much.
Continued success. Thank you.
All right. You too. Anne Liguori. And that wraps it up. Another edition of Cale & Company in the Books, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Thanks to Anne Liguori and Bob Ryan.